I'm Autumn Brown, a queer science fiction writer, a theologian, a mother of dragons, and a healing justice facilitator for social movements living in Minneapolis.
And I am Adrienne Marie Brown, a writer, student of miracles and love, emergent strategist, and pleasure activist paying rent in Detroit.
And this is How to Survive the End of the World,
our podcast about learning from apocalypse with grace, rigor, and curiosity. Hi, sister.
Hi, sister.
How are you doing?
I'm doing.
Do you want to go first? You want me to share?
I can go first. I'm definitely feeling heartsick over the loss of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I'm feeling, I'm also fucking like on my period. It's a new
moon. Me too.
New moon.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I'm like, it sounds like you have had this experience too, but I've like finally synced with the new moon.
Yes, I'm synced again. And I was synced with the full moon last year. So
me too.
Sister.
That's so weird.
Amaze.
Okay,
amaze.
That's weird. Wow. So yeah, it's like good to be synced and bleeding at the point that I'm supposed to be bleeding.
Yeah.
But of course I just, you know, with all the ways that my body has changed over the last, you know, decade plus, it happens. It feels different in my body now, you know, like 4 pregnancies later. Mm-hmm. It's just like it takes me out in a different way than it did when I was younger.
Yeah.
And had less babies under my belt, I guess. So I definitely feel fatigued and a little like tummy sick and sleepy, like all of the things, the like cocoon, that cocoon feeling of like, yeah. I just want to be under a pile of blankets.
Yes.
Eating ice cream and pizza.
Literal menu for the day.
So, and I did eat ice cream and pizza last night under blankets with my boo, and we watched episodes of the Jeopardy College Championship, which
hell
is
yes,
adorable. Oh my god, these teenagers, it's like they are so sweet to
it's
watch.
The sweetest thing.
It's just, yeah, that little bit of like, I don't know. It feels like it almost, even if it's like it was filmed last year, it feels like a blast from the past. So it has an air of,
yes,
was this filmed in the 80s? I don't know. You know,
literally anything before the pandemic. I'm like, wow, back when people just were up in each other's space. Look
exactly.
at this novel exactly. thing. Yeah.
Yeah. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great. I'm also in that, like period moment, and just like, I do feel, you know, early on in the pandemic, I was like, I don't think we should have to have our periods during the pandemic. And
pandemic just feels pause. Like,
and I know, I'm just like, I think anything else that can pause should. And I don't have, mine also, you know, I think as I've gotten older, my period keeps changing what it means. And this time around, I've started to really welcome it because I'm like, ah, I cannot do anything.
Yeah.
So I cannot do anything else but be
a reason to cancel.
Yes. And, you know, I have been watching the Nat Ministries post almost as a religious experience because she's really like, no one should be doing anything right now. There's a pandemic happening. We should not be doing anything that is like normal stuff. We need to rest. This is too much. And I feel like that every day. And then when my period comes, it's like, that's when I will give myself permission for the 2 days that it's like at the most intense to just be like, I am not capable, for real, for real. Like,
yeah.
I just need to sit on the couch and watch a movie with my parents, or I just need to lay in bed and be cared for. I need a hot water bottle.
And ginger tea.
I had mom freeze some pieces of my birthday cake. And so yes. I've been like defrosting one of them every so often and just being like, it's still technically my birthday as long as this cake is here. And my mom got me a balloon that is like, it still absolutely looks like the day it was purchased. I don't know what kind of balloon this is.
Helium balloons, man. That shit is.
It's a whole nother level.
Sustainable.
And so I just I feel like the dining room is still celebrating me. So yeah. I'm not going to stop.
Who am I to stop my own birthday celebration?
Celebrate me as long as it's needed. and yeah, I also will say getting the news about Ruth Bader Ginsburg last night was really, it was this feeling of, right, of course. I had this like immediate like, yep, of course. Like this is how this period of time is unfolding. Mm-hmm. And I felt just a rush of deep respect. Like this person had so many kinds of cancer and had such a conviction about how she held her role. And, you know, I think there's so many things to say about this government and about the world and about these roles, but there's something about being that committed to what you're doing. And
staying in as long as absolutely
and just being possible. Like, I'm going to stay in. Like, I feel like she and Chadwick Boseman were like on the same team somehow. You know, they were just like, I'm here to deliver a certain thing. It's needed. And I'm going to do it to the last breath. And it also just shows the precarity of our country, which is, it's so deep that like so much rests on this one 87-year-old woman.
Yeah.
Right. That it's like, oh my goodness. Like, you know, you're one of the last bastions of protection for so many different issues. And I think maybe that takes me into Flume of Rage realm.
What?
Is it time for the Flume of Rage?
The Flume of Rage!
That is a full no. Yeah.
The Flume of Rage!
The Flume of Rage!
The Flume of Rage.
What in the Flume of Rage?
I feel like there's so many crises overwhelming all of us at the same time. So it's like she died and then there was an earthquake in California shortly thereafter. And it was just boom, boom, boom. You know, it just keeps being like so, such a pace. And I feel rage about how uninformed the vast majority of us are about how our systems actually work. So we have this critique of these systems. We know they're not quite working for us, but in so many ways, we still don't really understand how they work. And I think it's so intentional. I think it's so intentional that it's like, oh, no one wants us to even comprehend how all of this works, because if we understood it all, we would divest in a lot of ways from the way that it's currently happening. And I think really begin to invest ourselves in new ways of governance, new ways of community relating and deciding things. And so I feel that I'm like, oh, you can feel the long impact of underfunding social studies and like lessening history and like just moving away in the kind of education, like just on a basic scale level that everyone has access to, of like, here's the world you live in, here's how it functions, here's what matters, here's what your responsibility is inside of it. And I feel that rage now, because then what happens is it feels like it's on organizers to try to be doing all education in addition to political education. So I see like so many of my comrades who have these brilliant strategic points that they want to be making, but they're having to like be like, oh, but also there's three branches of government. You know what I'm saying? Right. Like, here's what the judiciary does. And
let me send you the YouTube video about how a bill becomes a law.
Yes.
And then.
Yes, right? Yeah. And it's like that. So it's just that I think maybe the precise point of rage is the amount of labor that an average organizer is expected, it has to hold in order to even begin to move the rock, you know, that it's like, oh my gosh, like there's, it's just such a huge task. And I see people being worn down by trying to do all of what's needed in order to get people to even see the conditions that they're in. And, you know, I think the little bastion or the little beam of light that comes into that is like, poor people understand. Like, right. Poor folks get it. People who are actually like completely debilitated by the system, they really, really deeply understand how the system works in some ways better than anyone else. The swath of people that seem to need the most educating are those who are like middle class, mid-level education, like went to schools and actually kind of like believed in that and like have moved along these paths. And now there's, you know, you started to speak to it in one of our last episodes where you're like that, like double-mindedness, right? Mm-hmm. It's just this like, oh, I can't even believe this is happening. Like, how could this happen? And it's like, a basic level of understanding, how our government works.
And then, like, once you see it, you can't unsee it. You know? But only if you really see it. I've been thinking about that a lot, about the like, just that famous quote from Arundhati Roy: "Once you see it, you can't unsee it." You know, about systemic oppression. But then, but also reflecting on the amount of energy that does go into unseeing, you know, particularly among those who exist within the double-mindedness, you know, that in order to uphold that double-mindedness, you have to put a lot of energy into unseeing or not seeing the same information that's actually in front of you every single day. So I question a lot of that I would question just the, wow, that's like a lot of commitment that, and a lot of energy that people are expending. And which actually brings me to my flume, which is I'm really just increasingly getting very, very angry at people who aren't wearing masks.
And that was going to be my other
one. Just like, and on the one hand, I want to situate that behavior inside of a legitimately, all these things related to science, medicine, epidemiology, best practices, all that stuff has been politicized, which has created, I think, for some, a legitimately confusing atmosphere in which to try to make decisions. Especially if you don't want to see, or especially if you don't want
especially
to
if you don't want to see.
Think about the ramifications of this virus in your life or in your family's life, or if you experience yourself as having not been impacted by it, all those things.
Right.
But I keep hearing that sort of refrain of, well, the information is changing all the time. And I'm like, nope, the information really isn't changing all the time. You know, what the baseline foundational practices of safety for ourselves and others have not changed since the beginning of the pandemic. And they're not going to change, you know, just wear a mask, wash your hands, wear a mask.
Wash your hands, wear a mask.
And I think it really... I was, as I am often wont to do on Saturday morning, I was listening, watching the most recent broadcast of Democracy Now! And the show was featuring an epidemiologist named Dr. Monica Gandhi, who was talking about just this incredible block that Americans are having around mask wearing, and how our country is the only country where we're seeing this level of resistance to mask wearing across society. And that Right. And that, you know, obviously that's being fomented at the highest levels of government, but also has to do with a sort of like baseline difficulty in participating in civic society and thinking about, you know, she was advocating for like, you know, our messaging really has to change from protecting others to protecting yourself, because that's how Americans orient. And that is, it's very painful and angering for me to know that people need to hear it as being, to know that epidemiologists are looking at the situation and saying, we think that Americans really need to hear that this is best protection for themselves in order to make them do it. Like, that is fucking sad. That is fucking sad. Wow.
It's so sad. It's so sad because I remember the messaging at the very beginning where it's like, someone's grandmother and
your grandmother. Sort
of like the American way. It's like, fuck your grandmother, you know, fuck your kids, whatever. It's very disappointing. It's very disappointing. And the rage upgrades for me when I'm like, okay, well, if you aren't going to wear your mask, right, stay 10 feet away from me.
Right.
Like, follow the signs in the store that say walk this way, not that way. Like, the combination of behavior where it's like, I'm not only going to wear a mask, but I am going to get up in your face. On the Twitter, I saw people actually like a maskless march where these people went into Target or somewhere and pulled their masks off to march. And it's just like, really, you know, I always want to feel like, oh,
you want to feel
there's
like
not
that.
Evil. There's just misguidedness.
Hey, you want to feel like
hurt,
that.
There's trauma. I want to. But it's so interesting to see, you know, I mean, you and I grew up, part of our childhoods in Germany. And, you know, I always think back to living there and being like, gosh, you know, we're interacting with people and they're so kind. And these are also the descendants of the people who enacted the Holocaust, right? And I feel like that here right now. And I know there's some interesting memes going back and forth about like, well, Nazis learned that eugenic stuff from us and like, blah, blah, you know, like the back and forthness of it all. And I feel that here where there's all these people where I'm like, what you're doing in a daily practice is evil. And genocidal. And it's not hyperbolic to say so. There's enough bodies in the morgue that don't need to be there. It's a real thing. And you're still laughing and acting like it's a joke. And
can I say
like
something about the plume?
Yes. You can say something about it. And also, at some point, I want us to have flumes that are lighter rage, but I can't see.
I guess this isn't a lighter tip, but one of our listeners informed me via social media about they posted this. Have you watched the Challenger series on Netflix? There was a refusal by NASA to admit there was a flame coming out of the rocket booster before the explosion. They insisted on calling it a plume. Isn't that fascinating?
Oh my goodness.
This plume thing is just, there's more than meets the eye on the plume and the flume.
This is fascinating because when we looked it up, because after we decided not to do this research until after the first episode came out. But plume is like a long, soft feather, part of an animal's body that resembles a feather, a long cloud of smoke or vapor that resembles a feather, or a column.
I think that's what I was thinking of. Definitely a column of magma. I was thinking very, very scientific.
Yeah, column of magma. And then... that's you. Whereas the flume is a deep, narrow channel or ravine with a stream running through it. And
right. And then, I always think and then hearing this thing fire. About NASA being so, like, oh, plume was I this think, word that they applied specifically to not talk about flame is like fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's fucked up. It's fucked
exactly.
up.
It's very interesting.
In public.
So I'm glad that we're doing what we're doing in public here. This is going to be a show that is heavy from start to finish, mm-hmm. in, or at least from start to pop culture, top culture, because we want to talk about what's happening right now. And the only way we can talk about what's happening right now is if we really turn and face how to be with terror and how to be with grief. And we want to recognize that these are apocalyptic times. These are revolutionary times. We started the show because of times like these, anticipating times like these and wanting to be ready. And it feels like right now, here we are in terror. So we wanted mm-hmm. to spend some time with how do we turn and face terror and give ourselves some context for it. And we have a special guest who's going to be joining us a little later in the show.
Yeah.
To give us we some thought
it might be it might be helpful. Do you mind if I go ahead and just like take a first crack at this? Yeah. Here's where we are.
I was going to say, tell us where we are.
I think that, you know, one of the yeah. things we wanted to do is just kind of ground in, you know, what is actually happening right now? And obviously, there's been, since right. the election in 2016, there's been a progressive unveiling of the way that infrastructure of white supremacy is alive and well within the United States government, within various institutions of U.S. society. And I think that part of what we've seen inside that progressive unveiling is a sort of like deepening awareness and understanding among those who consider themselves maybe liberal to progressive, like on the political spectrum of liberal to progressive, deepening awareness and understanding that that there's a part of society that they have chosen not to take seriously, that they have chosen to orient to as sort of a joke or not a serious threat. An element of society that deeply subscribes to white nationalism, that is armed, that is organized, and that I think that like there's the liberal to progressive side of society that's finally starting to turn and orient to the threat that is actually posed by an armed white nationalist movement. Yeah. And I think that one of the things that's unfortunate about where we are in this moment is that it's taken people so long and folks have been so slow to actually turn and orient and see what's actually happening. And I think the other thing that has been slow, again, inside of the sort of like liberal to progressive end of political movements in the country has been, we've been slow to make the connections between various forms of state sanctioned violence against Black and Brown bodies and these, armed militias, these white nationalist groups that are organized. We've been slow to recognize the level of cross membership that exists between these bodies, right? The number of people who are both members of armed militias, members of white nationalist organized groups, and are also members of the police. So people are finally starting to kind of understand the level of organization that has existed on this end of society, and that some of the things that we've oriented to over the last 30, 40 years, you know, I'm thinking like the Oklahoma City bombing or other what we would consider lone wolf acts of domestic terrorist violence. I think there's been a kind of collective failure to recognize that even that, the lone wolf domestic terrorist, is part of their strategy. So that's part of what's happening, right? So we've got that happening. And then overlaid on that already very fragile and very deeply American infrastructure. We now have climate catastrophe very actively, very quickly unfolding at a speed and at a scale that many scientists weren't predicting would happen for another 10 to 15 years. And then overlaid on that, we have this pandemic. And the way the pandemic, both, you know, sweeping across society, the thing we were just describing in the Flume of Rage of like our country being particularly inept in managing its way through the pandemic. And also that long view reality that we've talked about in some of the other episodes of this show of having to really sit with the reality that this isn't even the big one. That inside of climate catastrophe, one of the other things that we're going to see more of is these kinds of viruses that come into come into contact with humans, specifically because of the way we are in relationship with animals in industrial agriculture, right? This particular virus is highly contagious and is deadly, but not deadly to most. And there have been other viruses that have been highly deadly to everyone who they come in contact with, but not highly contagious. And we have yet to experience a pandemic of a virus that is both, but the likelihood that we will is high. And so if we can't get this right, in terms of both a national response and a global response, it doesn't bode well for us as a country for the pandemic that may come. So that's how I would summarize what we're facing. Mm. Oh yeah, and then also the Supreme Court is in jeopardy.
Yeah. Yes. You know. Thank you for the summary, right? Pulling it all together, because it feels like this is the thing. This is the condition we're in right now. And I wanted to talk just briefly on like terror. What is terror, right? When we talk about it, and it's extreme fear. And it's when it's like, it's justified fear. It's, there's something that's going on and we can't find a way to find a balance, a grounding, like a, okay, here's how we're going to make our way through it. And we wanted to speak about this because so many folks, it's like, we're either trying to be normal, go back to normal. How soon are we going to get back to normal? When can we get to normal? And this is a conversation that you hear even amongst people who are trying every day to deconstruct what is normal and make a way for freedom, make a way for equality, make a way for justice, make a way for a new world. But when we're on the precipice of all of this system coming apart, what actually happens, what it actually feels like is, for many of us, extreme fear. And that fear is of a lot of things. Is my body going to be okay? Are my children going to be okay? Can I protect my family? Many of us now know the answer to all of it is no, that we have already been through the experiences of many of us losing people that we love, not being able to protect the people that we love, not being able to make decisions that we know would be the best decisions for them. And something I've been thinking about a lot and feeling into a lot is that the amount of terror and fear that people are feeling now is directly related to the amount of privilege that you have had in this society so far. So if you've had a lot of privilege, or even a sort of base level privilege, then this is really, really, really upending you. And now it's like, even if you have a lot of privilege, you're still facing new limitations on travel, new limitations on your safety, right? But for people who haven't had access to a lot of privilege, for trans folks, for immigrant folks, for Black male bodies, Black bodies, you know, there's been a lot of this targeting and this feeling of an instability, we're never safe, has been there. So I keep trying to remind myself of that, even though now it's like, well, now it's everyone. And that is a different feeling. It's a different experience. And, but I think it is important to also name that, that there are people who are more vulnerable, have been more vulnerable, and have been mm-hmm. saying, y'all need to pay attention. There's a climate catastrophe. You need to pay attention. Our health is not being attended to the way it needs to. You need to pay attention. We're being killed. We're being attacked. And as that spreads, that fear grows. And a context that I thought would be helpful here is a global context. So that because we're such a young country in relative, you know, relative to all the other countries that exist, we've been a young country, but also a superpower country. And there's a way that we center our story, and it feels really impossible that it could go in almost any other direction than global superpower forever as one united body. And so I thought it was just useful to say, you and I grew up half of our lives, basically, or at least for me, by the time I was 18, half of my life had been spent in Germany. I think for you it was about similar. Like, so we grew up half of our lives outside the U.S. as part of a U.S. military effort in Germany after World War II, right? The U.S. stayed. And so when I was young, I was in West Germany, right? It was still West Germany and East Germany. The Berlin Wall was still up. And while we were there, the USSR still existed. And our father was going for a period of time on missions to Yugoslavia. And, you know, during all that time, the troubles were happening in Northern Ireland. And it feels important, you know, that was just the world that we were around and in touch with. And that's just exactly, it was just like, this is just a little bit, and it's not even all of Europe. It's just like the little parts that we were in touch with. And then as we've grown and like look back, oh, also this whole thing was happening with Biafra and Nigeria. This whole thing was happening throughout the Middle East and going back, you know, for so long that we can't even really see the beginning of it. There's so many places that were once nations, that no longer are considered those nations, or were once federations of territories nations, no of nations that there are so liberated many places
themselves, and that liberation process was
exactly
required violent insurrection.
Exactly, right? It feels so important to remember that other places and other peoples have stood on these same precipices of, is there something here that unifies us together enough to stay as a nation? And if there is, what is it? How do we articulate it? And how do we uphold it as a standard that we fight for? And if there isn't, how do we challenge these structures and actually create new ones that can serve us? And I think it's a worthwhile question for us to be in, does the American experiment still make sense, or make the most sense as the experiment that we want to be in? And if it does, what is the right relationship with this white nationalist, hyper-capitalist arm of the nation? Is it something like in Nazi Germany, where it's like, we actually have to stop that arm. Like that has to be put under control. Seceding would not be the move because it wouldn't go far enough. This fascism is global and it's spreading and it's everywhere, and we need to take accountability for it. Or is it, we need to split from it? It's done so much harm and it's armed and it's right. So I think there's a lot of interesting conversations to be had in that realm. And there's also interesting conversations to say, well, do we just want to converge ourselves, partner with indigenous communities, and figure out where are places where mm-hmm. we can be in right relationship with Indigenous land sovereignty and find Black land sovereignty, brown land sovereignty, right. like, and actually just right. say there's,
liberated we want to create zones. Some
safe experimental spaces right. to grow. Exactly. So that's, you know, like the question I keep sitting with is the difference of what is a path that leads us towards a Zapatista future where many universes are possible, many worlds are possible, and we are fomenting our freedom and learning with each other. And what is a path that keeps us like we are now, powerlessly being moved along a genocidal conveyor belt. Right. And I feel like there's multiple paths available. But those feel like the sort of polar components of it. And to me, it feels super important to be like, we're not the first country in the whole world. We will not be the last country in the whole world. And we're not the first place to have this deep yes. of a values divergence that's turning us against so ourselves. Helpful. And so yes. putting ourselves in and, the context then of can help it, us it, face it, this terror.
It feels, mm-hmm. I know that this is something that you and I have been talking about together for many years, been talking about on this show for many years, that it is next to impossible to engage that conversation, to really engage that conversation, if we remain stuck inside of a state of being completely overwhelmed by the conditions, which is part of why we wanted to, you know, bring this conversation into the show today, to know that what are we experiencing right now? We're experiencing the yes. sense of being overwhelmed by terror and overwhelmed by grief. And when we are overwhelmed by terror and overwhelmed by grief,
that's right.
we enter a freeze state. You know, we our tendency will be to collapse,
yes.
to resign, to dissociate, mm-hmm. to cope instead yes. of acting, instead of making decisions. You know, I think back to the conversation mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. I had with the queer nature folks during the Apocalypse Survival miniseries, and the OODA loop that they described. You mm-hmm. know, the I'm trying to remember
yes.
it right. And there's the
people
the,
should go back
the
and
steps of the OODA loop are
yeah.
you know, to observe, orient, decide, act, right? That part of what we have to do. And, you know, and they were yes. talking about how easy it is to become overwhelmed inside of a survival situation, and that these are the steps that we use in order to take ourselves out of that state of overwhelm, freeze, dissociate, and actually be able to act, that we have to pause, observe our surroundings, yeah. orient ourselves in time, make a decision, and then act. And those are actually discrete steps in a process. And I keep thinking about, yes. well, how would we apply something like that? Like what is our OODA loop for, you know, October, November, 2020? What is our OODA loop for January, 2021? You know, how yeah. are we,
yes.
how are we actually, you know, as you were saying, before we hopped on this call, like, how are we moving? How are we coming to awareness of our fear and then moving inside of our fear together towards something that we actually want to survive?
Yeah. Right. Like, I think this is, you know, we're always trying to honor Octavia Butler in our work, but I think this is the thing that she always was teaching us, was like, we have to make compelling futures. We have to be compelled by destiny. Like, there has to be problems that are mm-hmm. interesting to solve. There has to be a sense that something can be done. And I think when we get frozen by terror, part of it is that we're taking in all of it at once and trying to then be like, oh, in my observation, I have oriented myself into a complete spinning top. Like, I'm trying to look in every direction at how bad it all is. And I think there is something right. about learning how to orient towards, what can I do? What can I do? What is possible for me? What am I skilled at? What do I long for? Who do I want to do this with? Especially mm-hmm. as we head into these next, as you mentioned, these phases, because there are some people right. who the move that they need to be making is direct action. Like there's a very good likely case that we are going to have to shut it all down, like, and be willing to truly be on general strike, truly stop business as usual, truly make it impossible to continue. Because the other side of terror, I was looking up the definition of it. They call a child a terror. Like when someone is in a tantrum and throwing a fit, it's right. That child is a terror. And I'm like, we have that as a president right now. We have a terror, a tantrum thrower, someone who will not play fair, someone who will not give up. So on those levels of terror, there's people who are going to have to fight. There's people who are going to have to protect. And I think those people shouldn't be judging each other, right? Like there's people who are like, I can't go out into the streets and where right. white militia are armed. I've got to stay and like protect the kids. And those communities need to be in conversation right. at a very intimate level. This has got to be community by community by community in these conversations. And everyone's got to go out and actually vote, because that's still one of the most viable strategies we right. have for
and we have to stop
some of the weight
yes,
of this
it's like
terror.
We have to and. I was hearing you say this in another conversation about everyone needs to be making a safety plan for the election time period, not just election night, but like the time period yes. around the election. And so it's like we have to be making our safety plans neighborhood by neighborhood, block by block, yeah. house by house. We have to be who's your crew? We have to be yeah. making
crew,
a plan for
like
how we're voting. And we also mm-hmm. have to stop orienting to the election as this point in time when we are going to suddenly feel some relief, right? It's like there's a lot of directions that things might go yes. as of the moment of the election and when the results are determined. And I think that there's going to be a lot of diverging paths, and a lot of it depending on what your geography is, but there's a high likelihood we will end up in a civil war kind of condition, right? And so we have to stop, you know, we have a president who is, you know, encouraging these armed militias to quote unquote protect their country if the result is not what he deems it to be or what he believes yes. will be fair. And so like there's a lot of things that, you know, and again, it's like, I'm not trying to be a doomsdayer here. I'm trying to be pragmatic, right? It's like, we're not heading into safety.
Right.
And I think there has to be a real,
yes.
kind of reality check around that. Like, what is the needs assessment given some of the variables that we're working with?
Yeah. And I think also looking at like the vulnerable populations now are going to also be the vulnerable populations in that period. So those, you know, the armed militia have really been targeting Black trans people, targeting people who they can look at and say, you look queer to me, targeting people with disabilities, targeting people who, you know, Black people, depending on where you are, targeting brown people, targeting immigrants, right? This has been happening and it's been increasing. They've been targeting protests, driving into protests, shooting people, killing people at protests. Like all of that is on the uptick. And, you know, I had someone tweet at me recently, like, you know, you say what you pay attention to grows and like, don't give him all this power. Don't give the president this much power, like, you know, because I had said I was angry about it. And for me, this is one of those moments where it's like, what you pay attention to grows. We need to make sure our attention is on reality and that we are growing plans that will actually get us through this period of time. And it's not a time to look away and be like, oh, just garden.
Right.
You know, I'm like, cool. Like gardening, I mean, actually, gardening is fantastic. And be gardening in a way that you're about to like feed a pod of people who otherwise need to not leave their home because they need to be hunkered down, hibernating, right? Like basically it's like tying it all together. Like there is a position for everyone to play right now. And one of the things, you know, maybe we can start to move in this direction of talking about the grief part of it, because one of the things I think that happens is this is a terrifying time, but part of what we're so scared about is that we're losing people that we love and losing things that we love, places that we love. Homes are burning that we love. Places are, trees that we love are gone. Like, there's so much to grieve. There's so much to grieve, and we don't really know how to grieve. And we keep having this way of articulating it. It's like, how are we all going to get there? How are we all going to get through this? And I think what we're seeing now is we're not going to all get through this. And I was saying this to Prentice. I did a podcast with Prentice, and it was like, we are losing people already. We will continue to lose people. That is true. Death is a part of life. Death is a part of the human experience. And right now we are in a period of a lot of increased grief, faster death, unnecessary. It's hard. And we are not all going to make it together. But what I do know for sure is that none of us are going to make it alone. This is not a time of the lone wolf. This is not a time of the individual successor, you know, survivor mode. This is, how do we get really good at being in relationship? This is not Matt Damon on Mars. This is humans trying to keep our species intact, keep our species moving forward, whether it's in these borders or not. We have to really, to me, I think the more we can relinquish our concept of the founding fathers, America, and move into, what do we have here? And is there something that can actually move forward? Yeah. And I think part of being in good relationship is knowing that we can grieve well, that when we do lose people, we grieve them beautifully. And we honor their lives.
It feels like a good place for us to bring in our guest, because I don't know anyone who grieves better than Malkia Devich-Sorrell.
Yeah. It's true. I love Malkia so much, and Malkia is a dear friend and someone who has in many ways created community that has helped others grieve, has helped me grieve. Officially, Malkia founded and then recently retired from the Center for Media Justice after being there forever, and is like basically a media policy and strategy genius. But Mac is also someone who's gone through a ton of intimate loss and intimate grief and found a way to make almost an organizing principle of being good at grief. And so we invited Mac to join us to talk about grief. Malkia, we are so grateful that you had a moment to sit down with us, and we want to ask you, basically the conversation we're in is about terror and grief and how part of what is so scary in this moment is having to face death and how ill-prepared we are to face it and how to move through grief and how very little time and space our culture, our society gives us and each other for moving through those things. So we wanted to bring you in because I see you as the kind of guide, like a light, you know, shining this light on like, hey, y'all, this is a part of life. This is a part of my life. This is a part of all of our lives. And you're either there or you're going to be here. And, you know, and you have done a beautiful job of creating both an honest cauldron, a container for speaking about your own grief, and spaces for people to be in grief together and feel the joy inside of life together. So I think just to start, could you tell us a little bit about how you have become
someone who knows so much about grief? You know, the story is long and not unlike the story that many, many Black people in America walk with and really Black people all around the globe. But I faced a lot of death in my life. And, you know, there are the deaths that have been kind of, you know, that have been, that have run throughout my life, you know, like friends. I had a girlfriend who was killed when I was 16, you know, cousins, you know, my cousin BJ, my cousin Njuzi, my cousin Javanna, my cousin Athena, all of whom were killed by accidents, domestic violence, gun violence, you know, the gamut, all of it. But I'd say the real, the deep and lasting relationship that I've had with grief has been two people. My mother, who had a lifelong genetic illness called sickle cell anemia, which many Black people have, and others from Mediterranean countries, and my wife Alana, who died from advanced cancer in 2018. And so kind of like my whole life, I lived with the fear of loss, you know, anticipatory grief, that grief that comes before the actual death. And I lived with the actual death. I was the person who was there when my mother was, when my mother died. I was with her, and I was with my wife when she died. And so I think that the combination of, like, you know, and besides these kind of facts, these were also two individuals that were very, you know, shaped me, basically, shaped me as a person in extraordinary ways. And I was extraordinarily close to both of them. So grief is definitely a cornerstone of my life. Loss is definitely a very big part of who I am.
I'm really grateful for your willingness to talk about this. I feel like it's so rare. To me, it's so rare to be around people who are willing to speak about the grief that they're experiencing and walking with. And what I want folks to hear from you, some of the things I feel like I've learned from you, is what do you wish people understood about death
and grief? I think a few things. You know, I think, you know, number one, that death is a part of life, it's natural. But the deaths that we have been subject to as oppressed people, they're unnatural. And that, you know, deaths that are coming too early, deaths that are unequal, that we have an unequal relationship to death and loss, that's not natural. That's not okay. I think that I want people to understand that when you live with generations of colonial terror, that you will fall subject to generations of colonized grief. And that part of our work is to decolonize our grief, take it out of the hands and imaginations of our oppressors and free it, you know, let our grief be free to be a part of our daily life, free to be part of the things we talk about. I want people to understand that loss is complicated, you know, and it gets more and more complicated the more people you lose. But it's also complicated by whether or not you have the right and the freedom and the resources to process it and to manage it, to navigate it. Those people, for example, who are working as essential workers right now, and I'm talking all of them, doctors, but really a lot of the nurses, you know, I'm talking about nurses and, you know, frontline medical staff. I'm talking about care workers and homes and, you know, but working class people for the most part, you know, where do those institutions provide them with any services to navigate the grief that they're absolutely going to experience, watching death after death after death? No, because they're expecting. They're expecting because workers and people who produce for other folks are expected to carry the burden of whatever that looks like. So death, when death is part of that productive process, you know, when you're caring for the human body and you know that death is going to come, you know, you're caring for dying people, the expectation is that you're just supposed to deal with that. You know, and you're not supposed to get nothing extra, no extra services. So there's a whole set of people, you know, and whether that's because of your racial position in the world or because of your class position or your gendered position, where your grief is disenfranchised, right? It's less important. You're supposed to carry it without speaking about it.
Right.
You're not supposed to stop what you're doing. You're supposed to keep working. You're supposed to keep going. And I think that we've learned that that is natural. So we walk with grief as a natural part of our daily life. And we don't even recognize that that's what it is. We think that's part of our personality. And I know it to be true because I know that's true for me.
Wow.
Thank you so much, Malkia, for just the clear naming of that reality. And inside that clear naming, I hear also a longing for a different reality, you know, and I also feel like I've seen you, since the pandemic began, take a role in crafting that other reality or trying to create space for this other reality. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could talk about pandemic joy. And what that space is, what inspired you to create it, and who is invited into it? Like, what happens inside that
thanks
space?
Thanks for asking about it. You know, so Pandemic Joy is like a weekly a gathering on Sundays, virtual gathering. And who's invited to it is friends and family. It's not an open public event. And the reason for that is that I believe that in this time and really in every time, but especially now, when isolation and really fear of dying, fear of being ill, right? I don't want people to even walk next to me, right? Because I'm scared that they're going to, you know, what you looking at, you know, you passing the virus, you know, in my direction. I don't want you to breathe towards me, right? And so that, under those conditions where we're terrified of each other, you know, we need to find ways to be connected. And so I know that's what I needed. So for me, you know, I was dealing with profound grief. My wife had died, but also I spent the year after my wife died caring for, you know, my my god sister and then my friend who also died of cancer. A year later. And so, and so I needed something. I could not go into this pandemic just isolated and alone. You know, I just couldn't go from having people staying at my house with me because I was terrified to be alone to them being completely and totally alone. So I decided to create a time when we could come together, and it grew over time. It wasn't the way it is now. It wasn't that way at the beginning, but you know, we sing, we use song, to express ourselves. We fellowship, you know, we talk about how we're feeling and what's going on. You know, we meditate, and then we hear from various, you know, I don't even want to call them experts, but various people that have done a lot of thinking about this question around grief and life, you know, loss and fellow and connection and community, all of these questions about how do we belong to each other? How do we belong to the land? How do we stay connected? And so that's how that goes. And I guess I would say about it, the last thing I'll say about it is, you know, people be saying to me like, "Oh, you do so much for the community, or you do this for them, or do that for other people." And I try to explain like, "No, this is a very selfish venture. You know, this was for me. You know, this was like, let me gather with the people that I love and care about, so that I don't feel alone." And it was based on the assumption that if I need it, so does somebody else. You know, and that's a difference between there's no martyrdom here. I'm not doing anything for anybody else. You know, I'm just creating opportunities for us to be together.
That's right.
You know what I mean? And that's for me, you know, that's for me. And That's
right.
You know, everything we do, we get something out of it. And when we don't acknowledge that, then that leads to other, you know, negative dynamics that I'm not interested in. I've been doing that for 20 years. I'm not trying to do that no more. This right here, this next piece of my life is for me. Mm. You know, it's for me. So that's about that.
I love hearing that, Malkia, and because I do feel like for anyone who's in a martyrdom practice, I do feel like there's something about going through a deep loss that turns that on its head. You know, it's like, and I don't know that I would have thought about it that way until you just said that. But there is something I feel like about being in grief and walking with grief that it's like we have to turn and face the reality that we're not actually going to rescue anybody, and we're not going to be able to rescue ourselves, and that can't be the goal or the purpose of our lives.
And that's the thing,
right?
So we actually
have to live.
And that's the big lesson for me is like, mm-hmm. I've been a controlling person, and you know, the loss of control breeds control, you know, and a need for control. And so I've wanted to control my environment, you know, because of how, you know, control and agency was taken from me, you know, at a young age. But what I've understood in this process of first losing my mother and then losing my wife and so many friends and family members is that I don't control shit. You know, I don't control a damn thing. Yeah. You know, cancer was not interested in anything I had to say. And so I realized that we just we have to live, you know. That's why we went to brunch, you know, even when my baby had to be in a wheelchair, or, you know, when she was going unconscious in the middle of the restaurant, you know, we still went to dinner. We still went to brunch. We played heads up all the time in the hospital room, you know. We had all kind of healing events, drumming and laying hands, and we sang all the time, and we had fun every single day. Even the days that were mostly spent crying, we still had a lot of laughter in them. And I believe in that. I believe that finding that joy, you know, that's the whole point of living. There ain't no other point.
That's it. I feel like this Thank has goodness. Been, you know, I'm a member of the Pandemic Joy community, and it's something that as a part of it, it's something that I wish for everyone. It's something that I wish for everyone. Not that there's some massive, big, huge church thing that everyone's part of, but that there's tons and tons of these small, intimate spaces where people get to be in community and seen and felt and heard, and that there's a rhythm of weekliness. It feels like Octavia Butler's Earthseed, like that there every week there should be a gathering of Earthseed to be with each other. And
that's
something that helps us feel belonging inside of life. You know, I know that we had a brief window together, but I feel like any moment I ever have with you, I think any moment we as humans get to hear from you as leader, as thought leader, as someone who is living their experience out loud and letting others learn from it is such a blessing. And so I wanted to thank you from us and from our listeners in the future who get to hear this for the wisdom that you just
Thank you for having me. I appreciate both of you. Thank you. I love you.
We love you so much. We are so grateful that Mac was with us. And Mac's time is so precious. Like, Mac's time is some of the most precious time of any human on earth. So we're really grateful that Mac could join us. And we didn't want to leave, even though this is a heavy episode, we didn't want to leave without some time on Top Culture, because Top Culture is helping us survive and move through everything. And one of the other things I was going to say during my flume of rage is that everything's moving so fast that right. it always feels like everything's out of date almost as soon as you say it.
I would say that's a social media effect. That's not
it's
even
the worst. But that's a social media effect. It's just like, meow. But I think one thing that makes a top culture top is that it doesn't matter how it's long so you wait top. To get to it.
It's so top.
Mm-hmm. It's that top that it's just, it's always worth the experience. And so we are months into living in a world in which Black is king. And it just feels like I want us to give some time and attention and love to Beyoncé, Giselle Knowles Carter's masterpiece project.
Yeah, let's do a little bit of time on this. Yeah. And, you know,
can we just,
and I feel like time on? There's part of me that just wants to give you the floor because I know you've watched it like at least 5 times. I'm probably more than that, I'm guessing. Yeah, okay. So that's real. Oh, and I've only watched it the one 15. Time and it was, you know, it was just the one. And I felt you know, so for me it's like I don't even have a commentary on it. It's more like, wow, oh, that. Hey, Herba! You know, like that was more my experience. I mean, I definitely remember feeling like it was like a really slow start. It was like almost too slow for me, but I was like, I'm staying with it because I know that like my fave songs from the Lion King soundtrack are coming. I know that like the keys to the kingdom is coming. So, you know, but for sure it was so beautiful to see the way the creative team gave life to these songs that have like been in the culture for, you know, over a year now or about a year now. And of course one of the things that I love in Beyoncé's work is whenever she takes some like racist shit and then like repurposes it into her work in this like, so, and that was one of the things for me with Brown Skin Girl, like watching everyone like decked out in this debutante, the costume of like the Southern debutante. Which is such a like racist and sexist like custom, and to see the creative team behind this project repurpose the imagery of that and into this like celebration of like motherhood, sisterhood, daughterhood, like just like rich skin, like Black femme rich realness skin, Black was like I love it when she does those kinds of reversals, and also felt like a lot of love for the some of the really tender presentations of the challenges of Black masculinity, the challenge of you know, the main character that you're following through the story, really experiencing fear, terror, lack of belonging, experiencing being haunted by loss, you know, experiencing finding love. And like, there was just a lot of tenderness in the way that character's arc is presented. So I really appreciated that, you know, I really appreciated that.
Life is a set of choices.
Does your father know you are here?
Lead.
I laugh in the face of danger.
Or be led astray.
Run away and never return.
Follow your light. Or lose it.
I love everything you said about about the work. And, you know, to me, Beyoncé is such an invitation all the time to take up creative space, like to take up space with your creative freedom. And where she's just like, whatever I did last time, I'm not doing that now. Now I'm doing this. And I'm going to bring my full, deep attention to this. And I feel like that with each of, you know, like if I do my scholarship around her work, then I'm like, oh, like with Lemonade, she was like, I'm going all the way into this heartbreak and I'm coming back out like transformed. And I'm going to now, you know, for HBCUs, I'm going to like go all the way in and do my homework and everything's going to be right. The costumes are going to be right. Everything's going to be right. And so for this, it's like, I'm going to trace my own lineage and I'm going to do it correctly. Like I'm going to do it right. And what that looks like is I'm going to engage artists that many of you have never even heard of before. And I'm going to uplift them as the sounds. And then those sounds are going to shape what this sounds like, which mm-hmm. is such a radical act to do with Lion King in the first place. Like just the idea of like Lion King is set in Africa, but Elton John is the person who's singing the song is, you know, it's like one of those things you're like, oh, wait, like why? You know, because Disney, right? And so she's like, actually, it's going to be artists from the continent who are going to be the sound of this journey. Like fundamentally, that's the first thing. Those are going to be the dances that we're doing. That is the culture of what this story actually is. And it's our story. We're all Simba in this. We're all people who were given some kind of gift and then displaced from that gift and distracted by the world and then returned to our deeper spiritual calling. And I love that throughout the work, she is Simba, her husband is Simba, her children are Simba. Like she just keeps showing us everyone gets to be on this journey of losing yourself and rediscovering yourself. And that, you know, she weaves in so many of the lessons. Like I always love, you know, I always love when she drops something because it's like, there's the Beyonce, there's the entire huge, huge, huge body of people who are like, Beyonce has given us a gift. Thank you. Oh, dear king, queen, everything to us. And then there's the entire industry of haters. Also,
I'm like, who's you?
It's an industry of haters, right? Who then run directly towards the work as well. And they pay for it. They want, because I'm like, if you don't have Disney Plus, you're not seeing this, right? She's like, this is for people who want to see this. So it's like, okay, so you came looking for her, right? And you came to find her in order to be like, here's my critique. And I think that those people get just as much joy from coming and getting to critique her as we're getting from coming and getting to just celebrate what she's created. But I also love that it's like so many people try to come for this piece of work for so many different reasons. And then I watched it happen, like where then people actually saw it and were like, oops. Well, I just won't say anything else because I'm like, she covered, you know, so many bases in this work. And, you know, I know that there's a whole body of people who would love for Beyonce to just disappear, right? Like she challenges so much fundamentally, her power, the way that she carries herself and the fact that she's like, makes so much bank doing it. You know, I think that people really struggle. And I think it's very fascinating. It's like people really struggle with folks succeeding inside of systems that they did not create. And with Black people struggling, particularly inside these systems. And I'm really curious and interested to see what this looks like as it continues to grow and continues to translate forward. Because she continues to get more and more interested in stuff that's like, the mainstream may or may not like this. Right? Like the mainstream may or may not be ready for a deep dive into African music and culture, but that's what I'm interested in. So that's where I'm going. And I'm interested to see how far she goes. I wanted to uplift all the thick and dark skinned and rich bodies that were in this work. Like it feels like she keeps listening, you know, and being like, okay. And Beyonce herself, this is one of the most thickest, beautiful.
Her body looks really, presentations really different.
Of her own body that I feel like we've seen.
Like so luscious.
It's wondrous, right? And I feel like, especially in the wake of Homecoming, because Homecoming, she was like, yeah, I busted my butt after having these babies and I got down to, you know, whatever, I had been like in high school or something. And yeah, it was like, she's like, I'm never doing that again. Mm. And then we see her so thick and
yeah, the Afrofuturism.
And then I love like the science embedded in
the whole thing. Exactly. It's funny with the critiques, because I'm, yes, I feel like, I've, you know, obviously I feel like everyone has the right to, you know, whatever feelings they have, but but there's some part of me that's like, just like your energy is really like going, like I look at that and I'm like, if you could just spend like 10% of the energy that you spend on critiquing and hating our people and direct it at Jeff Bezos. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, Jeff Bezos has become exponentially more wealthy during the pandemic. Like, go hate him and go go do something. No, hate, maybe not hate, but like, go take your critique and put it where it actually fucking matters. That's like my invitation to everybody right now. I'm just like, how about, instead of like turning your like vitriol, critique, and nastiness on like those folks who are like producing beautiful cultural work or are like producing meaningful experiences for people, go put your critique on the folks who are actually damaging our planet and are damaging our economy and are exploiting workers. Like, it's just like, please, like, what, it, to me, it's like, it's like the definition of like horizontal violence, personally. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and it's so, it always makes me so, it's so sad to me, right, too, because I'm just like, oh, this person has made jobs. Like, she's just gone and created a ton of work for a bunch of people who are very, very happy to have it, and like very, very happy to be dancing with her and singing with her and like uplifting, seeing their culture uplifted by her. And I'm like, that's who you want to, as soon as she comes out or before she even gets out, you want to say, you know, I saw all kinds of stuff. People are like, I just don't see why she had to be in it. I can't remember where I saw this, but I'm like, wait, so you don't see why a Black woman would need to like put herself in work that she had written, produced, directed, and created? I try so hard because I'm like, when I read critiques of her work, I also try to imagine like which Black men would receive these critiques, which white men would receive these critiques. Like, who else do we feel comfortable speaking of in this way? Because I'm like, it's always fine to critique someone's art, but with her, it rarely feels like they're critiquing the art. It really feels like so often it's a critique of just who like, she is as a person and how she chooses to live her life. Like, again,
10% of that energy on Woody Allen.
Why?
Like, there's just so many other people that you could go spend your energy on. That's all I'm saying. All I'm saying. Like, take a percentage of it, just a portion of that. It, and there's, go put it,
literally,
you know, on like a pedophile or someone who is a rapist or like, you know, someone who has like persistently violated labor law. I'm just imagining that there's a lot of people out there. Anyway.
Yeah, just all the people that. It's so good. And, you know, I don't want to be anti-critique. You know, I don't, because I'm like, there's things that make sense to critique. There's things that make sense to critique. It's not my mode, right? So I'm like, if you're going to do it well, do it accurately, and do it once a project is actually out. And so you can, you know for sure that like the thing that you're critiquing is actually happening. And I feel like that's one of the things that's been happening lately is people be like, I haven't seen it yet and I don't know, but here's what I think. And I'm like,
the critique that begins with, I don't know anything about this, but
wait.
Blah, blah, blah. Am I right?
Yes, but anyway. Then I'm like, So anyway, too. This ended up becoming a critique of critique, and that's fine too, because fuck that. Okay, so I will keep it short, but here's the thing I want to say about her on an overarching note, which is I believe that she keeps raising the bar, and to me, one of the most fantastical things she's ever done is the Esther Williams tribute part of the movie, in which she did an entire scene where everyone is diving into a pool and swimming into the pool. Ooh. And doing synchronized swimming. Like, who else is doing that for us? Like, who else is like, do you know what you need to see is me doing a synchronized swimming with 300 people.
She's very generous.
I don't know who else is so generous. She's so generous. That's, yeah, sorry. That's just the note. I was just like, Black is King is so much better than we like. I don't want them to get the last word.
The abundance, Esther Williams, the generosity, tribute. The magnanimity. Thanks for listening to our show. We're on Twitter and Instagram at End of the World PC. We're also on Facebook at End of the World Show. And you know what? We're ignoring the haters on all those platforms.
Do we have haters? You can make a sustaining donation to our show by visiting our
another
page
incredibly at helpful thing.
patreon.com/endoftheworld.
I don't know why I am on one tonight. Right? No, I'm about to like get
you're gonna
so many like emails and messages. please write us a review saying anything that you want on Apple Podcasts if you're an iPhone person.
How to Survive the End of the World is produced and edited by the incomparable Zach Rosen, who might
music,
help us by
or we might leave it all in. Music for today's show comes from Tune Day, Lonnie Ron, and Mother Cyborg.
We'll leave everything. Okay, girl, go pee.